Hello. Good morning, everyone. We had a great keynote this morning from a wide range of speakers talking about community or code, community or licenses, and another company investing in Apache projects, helping Apache projects becoming successful. Joey and myself were in a community meetup about a year ago. We were all talking about, it's a microservice architecture meetup. We were all talking about different architectures and the scale. Many community engineers approached us and asked these questions of how do we operate Cassandra and the scale at which we operate Cassandra. Even though those questions seems repetitive for us, but those were legitimate curious questions on operating Cassandra at scale. And when we said, we operate Cassandra at a petabyte scale, everybody was like, wow, really? What does it take to operate Cassandra at a petabyte scale? That's when we both thought about, finding a right venue to talk about operating Apache Cassandra. And ApacheCon is the best venue to talk about, Apache projects. And here we are. Next 45 minutes, we will be giving our brain dump of philosophies, tools, and techniques in running Apache Cassandra at a petabyte scale. Without further ado, let me introduce ourselves. I'm Vinay Chella, Distributed Systems Engineer, part of Cloud Data Engineering team at Netflix.
And I'm Joey Lynch, also Distributed Systems Engineer on the Cloud Data Engineering team at Netflix. I work on Cassandra and many other data stores.
But on a high level, today we'll talk about why Apache Cassandra at first place and scale of Apache Cassandra at Netflix, and we'll tell you the story of a Cassandra cluster in Netflix ecosystem. Where does it start, and how does it start? Once it starts, how do we ensure we run it at a scale to satisfy sub 10 milliseconds 99th latencies? And when it is a time, how do we decide to move on? And also at the end, we would like to also share how Murphy's Law applies even for Netflix's Cassandra. Before getting into that, let me give a little introduction of where we come from. I guess this is a company which doesn't need a lot of introduction, but let me help the folks out there who are missing the enjoyment, having an opportunity to have a entertainment delivered to your home screens across different devices, different platforms, right on your couches. We are the online movie streaming company available to stream across the world, except few countries for reasons. And according to individual company statistics and survey, we serve 1/3 of internet traffic, bringing a spark of joy for more than 150 million subscribers and households. When I say 150 million households, that is without account sharing statistics. So, but this brings us, interesting set of problems in our ecosystem, serving millions of operations per second, satisfying, global data requirements and availability of data across the globe with a seamless movie watching experience to our subscribers. And having a failure isolation at a rack level to provide always on experience to our members, and also being a database, which is a critical part of our business, holding the critical piece of data, being it kiosk ready all the time, and providing tunable consistencies to serve variety of use cases across our service stack. But not the least, providing, have an easy flexibility for the rest of our technology stack to work with the data, being a log structured storage engine. With these wide range of requirements, we get an answer of why we use Apache Cassandra at first place. Talking about scale, we operate tens of thousands of Cassandra instances with hundreds of global Cassandra clusters with more than 6 petabytes of data across the globe, which is taking almost millions of request seconds with several gigabytes per second global data replication across our data centers. As we are a storytelling company, Today, we would like to tell the story of a Cassandra cluster in our ecosystem. We'd like to put it into four different episodes. Inception, where does it start from? How does it start? And how do we ensure it is running all the time? And how do we migrate and move on? But as part of the first episode, we would like to get an answer, where does it start? Well, most of things and, many operational or, product things comes from someone trying to solve a problem, be it a technical problem or a product problem. And figuring out which data store to use, to solve that problem. That is when we get involved as a cloud data engineering team to come and help them. Our philosophy is very simple here, providing a context over control. Instead of giving them the decisions on which data store to use, which data model to use, we rather give more context, detailed context on, what is the right tool to use and what is the right data store to use by focusing on, developer education and tooling. But that gets a little tricky. When you give your application teams freedom to choose whatever the data store that they want, it comes with, cost. That totally lies in the heart of our culture, freedom with a responsibility. And in our context, that responsibility is tied back to, service level objectives. SLOs are key as part of our service. When we say service level objectives, we talk about how much payload our service team is expected to send to the data team, and what is a latency guarantee and what is a availability guarantees a data team has promised to satisfy, without breaking the SLOs. When any of these parties break the SLOs, be it data owner or being the data producer, whoever is breaking these SLOs, these parties held responsible. Let's say if there is a service which is going over these SLOs and breaking the SLOs, and both of these teams will be as part of your war room trying to fix the problem and take it forward. All of this lies with a very simple contracts that we follow across our service stack, API contracts. In our data teams scenario, we ensure the API data API contracts that we promise to our customers, being it a SQL, a Thrift in Cassandra case, is not broken at any given point of time without compromising on latencies and availability. Same as the data owners have certain contracts to their data consumers. They try to not break their API as same SLOs across the stack. So these are the tight contracts that every team tries to establish between them. But there are some loosely coupled contracts as well. For example, data consumers try to get the data from data owners like us through data warehouse contracts, which are not tightly coupled contracts, but still we try to promise and fulfill those requirements. Once a team decides based on based on certain characteristics, which data model to use, which data store to use, how do they get more information about it, and how do they get to start working with it? That's where the developer education comes in. We invest heavily in developer education. We believe giving a detailed context over control leads a long way for our engineers and for our entire ecosystem. I have taken one masterpiece example of our context sharing document. Here, this document is talking about picking a right data store. If you focus on what we are talking about here, so we're talking about objectives that any particular data store can achieve in terms of operations, in terms of scale, in terms of durability, in terms of consistency. Along with this, we also publish detailed performance benchmarking numbers in our Netflix ecosystem, and durability guarantees and consistency guarantees. Because picking a right data store at the first place is key. We try not to force everything onto Cassandra. We try not to force everything into one data store. Rather, we give enough context for engineers to take the decision And one key important aspect here about Netflix ecosystem. Along with choosing the right data store, it is also important for engineer to choose and keep an eye on the total cost of ownership for the whole organization. You know, when they are onboarding a certain new data store, how much does it cost? You know, Netflix in overall ownership. You know, integrating with the rest of your ecosystem like metrics, discovery, and offline systems. So that also we share as part of our context sharing documents. After enough developer education, let's say when the developer chooses a data store to try working on. In our case, let's say a developer chooses to work on Cassandra. It is also important, I mean, with even with the detailed context sharing, even with the detailed one-on-one conversations, sometimes engineers try to, you know, prove certain theories. You know, they have built some mental model, and they try to prove it out if it is working or not. If you don't provide the tooling, which is easy enough for engineers to try things out, it is hard for them to, you know, keep iterating on those decisions. That is why we invest heavily in the tooling. You might have heard in many different talks, Netflix heavily invests in all the tools and infrastructure to support our service stack. Our platform organization is pretty big for the same reason. So here I have taken an example, screenshot of a Cassandra cluster in our CDE self-service. I think the picture is not great, but so here we are talking about a one-page view where customers, when they are trying out a Cassandra cluster for their requirement, they can figure out how many requests it is taking at 99th and 95th latencies, and also getting trying to zoom in at one part of it. As we operate on AWS, it is also important for engineers to figure out the cost of that particular solution, right? So we try to give insights into how much are EC2 costs, how much are S3 costs. Of course, these numbers are just demo, they are not real numbers. And also, not just providing data store as a black box service to your engineers. The moment when you start providing your data store as black box services, you try to take on more responsibility in your data team. As a result, you won't be able to scale to a petabyte scale. That's where the SLOs, going back to SLOs, are key. And giving as much granular detail as you can to your service is a key part of our offering. So we try to give what maintenance is running, what kind of backups are running, what kind of repairs are running. Not just high-level details, but you can our developers can dig deeper into each individual table-level repair, and they can tweak the settings at a table level. In terms of backup, they can figure out how much is it costing their cluster, how much is it costing to choose a solution or a different solution. They can tweak those settings to optimize on the cost and backup. So if you see any of these systems, CDE team is not directly involved. Right? So we provide enough tooling for them to take the right decisions. And if any of these SLOs are broken, each party will be accountable to fix it, take it forward. So when you're operating a distributed database, you're talking about tens of thousands of nodes. Giving a node-level insights is also a key part of this tooling, because they can figure out how many instances they are talking to, and they can work on their load balancers and much more detailed stuff at node-level statistics. But key area that I would like to highlight is how do we ensure these SLOs are well agreed upon between two teams. As you can see in this screenshot, we are talking about how much payload a service team can send it to the data team. A data team is promising to satisfy certain 99th and 95th request latencies. And when any of these systems are broken, we figure out whom to page, and our systems will page respected parties automatically. But all in all, try to make good contracts, which makes good partners, and which makes it easy for you to start scaling your infrastructure. The next episode that I would like to talk about is provisioning. Once we figure out with a detailed context sharing which data store to use and how to use, how does it start in our ecosystem? So as part of this episode, we try to get up and running a Cassandra cluster in our environment. But for that, let me give you the tooling that we have. So with the help of few button clicks, or maybe one button click, we can start Cassandra cluster. This is where we gather all the requirements and start spinning Cassandra cluster. Once we start spinning Cassandra cluster, it could be up and running. But before that, as a Cassandra development team, we need to ensure that every piece of code that we are shipping to our environment is well tested. So we believe in the philosophy of prove it before you serve it to your customers. So this is a two-step process that I would like to talk about, which is building a robust AMI build process and also pre-flight check. So these two aspects talk about two different things, which I'll get into details. The first is the AMI build process. AMI, as we are in the AWS ecosystem, AMI is Amazon's mission image, which is an immutable infrastructure. When we commit a piece of code in our Cassandra ecosystem or any of our data store infrastructure, we go through non-linear development model, where you can have 10 or 15 different branches of Cassandra running on your machine, serving hundreds of different clusters. So as you can see, our AMI pipeline goes through a rigorous functional testing as well as performance testing. As part of functional test, we try to ensure all of our automation is well tested on every commit that you're doing. And also, as part of performance test, we identify major use cases across Netflix, and we try to ensure that we are not introducing any regression as part of the commit. Once these pipelines have passed, we tag a particular SHA commit to be readily deployed in our production environment, and then once we approve it, it automatically deploys to all tens of thousands of instances. But that's not where it stops. For example, you ensure your code is ready, you ensure your code is rock solid by functional testing and performance testing. But when you put your code into a certain environment in AWS, now this is, I took a EC2 instance lifecycle statistics and built a bathtub curve of instance lifecycle. So when EC2 instance starts, through the initial stages of its lifetime, there's a high chances of failure. Once you cross that time, there's a long tenure where that instance can live healthily, and there is a degraded stage where instance gets bad. It is important for you not only to ensure that your code is rock solid, but your instances which are serving your production traffic is is healthy and serving your requests without compromising on any tail latencies. So as part of pre-flight check, we ensure before launching any instance and putting it up for the traffic, we ensure are the disks ready to be served the traffic that we are expecting? Are the networks are healthy enough for us to start using it in the production? Every instance in our environment goes through this pre-flight check process. Even though it delays the instance boot up time, but it gives enough confidence for us not to compromise on tail latencies, both in terms of writes and reads. But the rest of the talk, we're going to talk about once we ensure the pre-flight check ensures that the instance is healthy and up and running, how do we ensure throughout the period of instance lifecycle, how do we ensure that instance is still healthy before our customers pages about tail latencies? With that, I'll hand it over to Joey to talk about the remaining two episodes.
Thank you, Vinay. So I think that we've gotten a really compelling story for how you set up your infrastructure for success when you're trying to scale up to petabyte level Cassandra clusters. Some key insights are things like the ability to shard out your clusters, building those control planes to actually allow you to operate hundreds of clusters and allowing you to meet these SLOs. But the rest of this talk is going to be, how do we actually meet those SLOs? How do we make sure that the Cassandra clusters operating at hundreds of terabytes or petabytes scale are able to meet those promises that we've made our customers? And I would say that the really key The most key insight is that we had to shift as a business from operating imperative control planes to instead operating declarative control planes. So I think everybody in this room has probably at one point or another either seen or interacted with an imperative control plane. It's pretty straightforward. It's just like imperative code. You have a control plane which like looks at the world and says, okay, I think I need to take these actions. And then it messages every node in your infrastructure saying, it's time for you to act, it's time for you to act. Contrast this with a declarative control plane, where the only interaction that the control plane has is through a data store of some type, what we call desire stores or intent stores. And this is really key because it means that your system shifts from the control plane being responsible for driving that to completion to instead every node in your infrastructure is constantly planning and acting to try to move the state of the world towards desired state. But these two control planes designs have some trade-offs. So in particular, the most important one is that the imperative control plane is simply easier to implement. It's easier to understand. Even just looking at this diagram, you immediately are like, okay, yeah, I understand how that works. Whereas declarative control plane is a little bit harder to understand. And this is why we think that most people start with imperative control planes. Netflix started with imperative control planes when we had one or two or three clusters. When you have 10 nodes, SSHing in a for loop to 10 nodes is not a big deal. But as you start to scale to tens of thousands of nodes, the system starts to become fragile, and you start to see little cracks forming in your infrastructure. And this is for a lot of reasons, but one of the biggest ones is that you have to implement parallelism. These imperative control planes are inherently slow. They're inherently sequential. And when you're running with 10,000 nodes, if it takes a minute per node, you're going to be waiting a long time. Contrast this with declarative control planes, which are, we believe, in the long run, lower total cost of ownership. At this point, Netflix's declarative control planes are essentially self-driving. And they're also parallel out of the box. But this also, of course, has a trade-off, which is that they're parallel out of the box. And so you have to actually stop them from being too parallel. For example, if your declarative control plane were to restart every node all at once, this would be very bad. So you have to take that into account. Now, if you're curious how to know if you're building an imperative or a declarative control plane, a good way is to look at the tool set that you're using. So engineers who are building imperative control planes reach for imperative tools. They reach for orchestrators, things like Jenkins, where you can set up like a job that runs some bash code, or Fabric, Python's Fabric orchestrator. And these run fundamentally imperatively. They have a recipe that runs one step after the other. Contrast this to declarative tools, where you're usually reaching for data stores. You're reaching for things like Apache Zookeeper, which gives you great functionality like watches and the ability to do blocking queries, so that your nodes can say, wait until the state of the world changes, wait until the desire changes, and then take action. Or even Cassandra. We use Cassandra for a number of our declarative control planes. And if you are familiar with the actor programming language, declarative control planes are often programmed similar to that. So every node is following some state machine, and then they're using a state store, like a database, to mediate those transitions. All right, so now let's get into the concrete examples. So we'll go through kind of some easy maintenance tasks all the way to the most complex, and we'll model them as how do we solve them as a declarative control plane. And to do that, we're going to follow a three-step process for each one of them. We're going to figure out which desires do we care about from a data store. Then we're going to obtain the state of the world. And if those two things are not the same, our agents will take actions. It's as simple as that. And to illustrate that, we'll start with how we used to do an imperative solution, and then I'll show you how we transitioned that. So ring health is a very important maintenance activity in Cassandra, because operators need to know, is my Cassandra cluster healthy? Do I have, are all my nodes up? Can they all see each other? And our original implementation looked something like this. The Jenkins server would reach out to every node in our infrastructure and say, hey, are you okay? Hey, what about you? Are you okay? And this worked great when we had 6 nodes or when we had 12 nodes. But as you start having 10,000 nodes, you end up running into all these scalability problems. Like, what happens if node 3 doesn't respond? Is it healthy? Is it not? We don't know. How do we tell? It's hard to synthesize a global view of hundreds of clusters and tens of thousands of nodes from one position. You only have a single network path. And furthermore, you don't have any way to store all that state. You don't have any way of knowing, well, has it been healthy for the past 30 minutes? Jenkins doesn't have any way of really using a database. So instead, we transition to a declarative implementation, where every node in our infrastructure is constantly emitting health data to a health check database. And you can see here that now instead of some central coordinator reaching out and saying, are you okay, now every node is constantly emitting metrics about its notion of the ring health. And this means that we can use a stream processing application. It's an internal application, but it's something like, you can think of it like Flink, which can then kind of hold a state of, okay, well, given the streaming updates I've gotten, what's the state of the world? And then from that, we can construct really useful visualizations such as this, where we can actually show operators which nodes are able to talk to a dead node and which ones aren't. But this is uniquely enabled by having that state and having that capability. So let's map it back to that three-stage process. So the desire is that we want a cluster to be healthy within 30 minutes. The observation is we have a streaming continuous observation of the cluster state stored in our data store. And then the action is that whenever we violate that desire, we're going to either auto-remediate, if it's like a single node, or we might page an operator. But we take it even further. We can do this for single node health as well. So the thing that Vinay talked about where nodes can go bad, well, when you're running 10 or 20,000 nodes, nodes go bad all the time. So we used to have this Jenkins job that would just reach out and say, hey, are you healthy? But it turns out that this has a pretty big architectural problem, which is that unhealthy nodes are hard to talk to over the network for any number of reasons. Their network might be degraded, their disks might be degraded. It's pretty common for your SSH agent to assume that it can log to disk. So if your disk stops working, it's hard to log in with SSH. Or in our case, if our maintenance agent stops working because it can't log to disk, then you can't tell it, hey, check the health. So what we realized was that we could reconstruct this pretty easily as a declarative control plane. Instead of having a central coordinator reach out to every node, now every node in our infrastructure runs local checks and then emits external messages saying, I need help. I need to be killed because I've gone bad. So in this case, the desire is that degraded hardware should die within less than 10 minutes. The observation that every node is running against the state of the world is, what is the state of the local file system? What is the state of the local disks? Are they meeting our latency SLOs? And then they emit a message. The action they take is, hey, please, somebody do something with me. And the control plane uses a locking service to limit the parallelism so that we can only terminate one node at a time. But sometimes your software goes bad. It's not just the hardware that can fail. Sometimes your software goes bad. So if you run Java databases, how many of you have ever had it go out of memory or go into a garbage collection spiral of death, or a couple people, one or two, anybody? Nobody? Really? Okay, at least a little bit of the room. We run into this too. We run Cassandra, we run Elasticsearch. Every now and again, people will send it a query like, load your whole data set into memory, do it right now, don't use paging, turn off all safety features. And we're like, what? But this happened frequently enough at petabyte scale that we had to design a declarative control plane to deal with it. So what we do is we attach an agent to our Java programs called JVMQuake. And what it does is it constantly monitors the throughput of the JVM. So throughput is just how much time you spend running application code versus how much time you garbage collect. And typically a healthy operation is spending more than 90% of its time running code. And you can see here in the healthy operation, there's like this token bucket of garbage collection debt. And when the code runs, we drain out of that debt. And when the code pauses, we add to that debt. And then we can say, okay, well, if we ever accumulate more than 30 seconds of garbage collection debt, something's really wrong. So what we're going to do is we're going to stop the program. We're going to take a core dump, stream it up to S3 live so that we don't have to, you know, manually intervene. And later our operators and developers can debug what actually happened. But then we crucially act and terminate the node and basically kill it, give it this you know, kind of graceful death. You know, last time I checked, this was happening about 4 or 5 times in production across a fleet. And we've debugged numerous bugs in Cassandra, in Elasticsearch, in our applications because of this. All right, so we've seen how we handle single node maintenance activities. Now let's try to get it a little bit more advanced. So we also use declarative control planes for how we do backup and restore of Cassandra. So we've never had an imperative control plane here. It's always been declarative. It's pretty straightforward. We look at the state of the data on disk, and then we look at the state of data in our backup, and we say, what's different? And then we only upload the difference. And this is crucial at petabyte scale because you can't upload 6 petabytes of data every night at 2 a.m. AWS is going to be really unhappy with you if you try to stream all the data to S3 as a full snapshot every single day. But you don't need to. You're not mutating 6 petabytes of data every day. Instead, you're only mutating small amounts. And so the backup system follows, again, this declarative algorithm to say, oh, I only need to send SS table 8. And then this is really quite key because you can do this kind of continuously so that you're always uploading small amounts of data instead of like every morning at 2 a.m. uploading the whole world. The final one that I want to cover is the most complicated control plane that we've built. And that's for Cassandra Repair. And I just want to get into the details for a little bit here because I think it's important to understand the context of why this control plane is so complicated. So Cassandra is an eventually consistent database, but only if you run repair. It's only eventually consistent guaranteed to our customers. We can only make that promise if we are able to run repair. And repair requires us to run a three-step process where Cassandra validates pieces of data by hashing them. So it takes ranges of data, calculates a hash. Then it compares those hashes, and in this case it says, hey, range one is different. I got the hash CE4D on one side, and I got the hash EEF4 on the other. And it says, well, those are different, but I don't know which one's right, so I'm just going to send the data that both of them have to each other. So in this case, you can see replica B and replica A are exchanging their data for hash one, for range one. And then finally, the Cassandra compaction process, which is the CRDT process by which Cassandra resolves conflicts, is the one that actually decides, okay, 2281 is the correct one. But we have a slight problem here, which is that as the amount of data that you're hashing gets large, you start losing resolution. So if you're hashing 8 partitions per leaf of your hash tree or 4 partitions, that's a difference in how much extra data you have to stream when something's wrong. So we call this the overstreaming factor, or inversely, the resolution of the repair. So as you get more than 2 to the 18 or 2 to the 20 partitions, Cassandra starts losing resolution on the leaf nodes of your tree. And this is because you have to pay memory for each one of these leaf nodes. So you can't just have one per partition at scale because you'll run out of memory. And to kind of do the math for that, this is a real production node with 112 million partition keys on one node. This is a 300 node cluster, 112 million partitions. So this is a problem because if we wanted to create a hash tree which covered all of those partitions, we would need 216 gigs of memory all at once. And we don't have that in one node. So instead, we have to sacrifice resolution, and we end up overstreaming a factor of 512, which means that if 1 meg of data is inconsistent, we have to stream 512 megs. This is a problem, and this necessitates what the Cassandra community calls subrange repair, where you break down the range into lots of little bits. But that becomes a problem, because when you have an imperative repair solution, which is issuing little range commands, and maybe thousands or millions of range commands, you're going to end up with a lot of these commands from your central coordinator. And these commands are being executed over remote JMX, which any security folks in the room know is a terrifying remote code execution just waiting to happen. Like, we have Jenkins, which is remote code execution as a service, and then we have JMX, which is remote code execution as a service. So this system is, like, no good, and we don't like this at all. We also don't like it because it's a single point of failure. If that Jenkins machine fails and we lose that progress, we might have to resume a repair that might have been taking 6 hours or a day because we've got all that data. So when you have a one-month Jenkins job and you're like really praying, like, please don't let this job fail, because if this job fails, I have to redo a month of work, it's time to move on from your imperative solution. So we did. We built a declarative solution, which is the distributed control plane, which makes progress whenever the repair database is available. Every node independently is constantly asking the repair database, is it my turn to repair? And then once, in this case, like node 2 has decided it's my turn to repair, they're constantly checkpointing, saying, this is how much progress I've made. I'm on this subrange, which means that we can resume whenever the nodes crash and save all that time. And the reason why I said this is one of the more complex declarative control planes is because the state machine that each node has to finish is actually extremely complex. This is actually a simplified version of the state machine, but you can see how it's interacting with different pieces of state. It's asking, like, is the repair running for my cluster? Is it my turn in the cluster to repair? If it is my turn, let me go checkpoint my status as I do subranges. And we agree, like, this looks kind of complicated and annoying, which is why we're trying to actively open source it. It actually is already open source in 1.4.3.4.6 in Cassandra open source Apache ticket. It's on hold until the feature freeze list lifts, but we are actively trying to contribute this back to the community. All right, so to kind of wrap up, I think I've taken you from kind of simple orchestration all the way to the most complex, and shown you how you can take things that historically might be imperative solutions and then transform them into declarative ones. And at the end of the day, you end up with something that looks like this, where you have self-driving databases which just heal themselves, they run themselves. The only interaction that we as humans have to do is, like, click buttons in a UI or set desires into a data store, or, you know, when we get the page, we have to go debug it. But that's really, this is the goal. This is how, if you want to think about it, this is the key to running large-scale Apache Cassandra. And with this, I'll hand it back over to Vinay to show you how we migrate at the end.
All right. So we talked about how to start a Cassandra cluster and how do we keep it running for a long time. But there are times when you decide to move on, maybe changing the software version from one Cassandra to another Cassandra version, or maybe migrating the data from one system to altogether different system. So our philosophy here is very simple. So we focus on two important aspects here. One is piggyback on immutable infrastructure that your ecosystem, your provider gives, and also give a seamless and transparent migration to your users. So first I'll talk about software migration. So tying back to what Joey was talking about in intent-based solutions, so we have a system, we have an instance in AWS with holding terabytes of Cassandra data, and let's say that is on AMI 9AA3, and there's an agent which is working for you all the time, which is asking your desired store, like, what is the AMI that I'm supposed to be on? Let's say your desired store starts saying, well, you're supposed to be on a different AMI other than the one you have. So then this agent can decide to, upgrade the instance. But this is where the complication comes in. So as you are operating a stateful service, not a stateless service, ensuring that you're not, compromising on quorum, you're not compromising on any promised SLOs that you promise to your customer is key here. And agent has to build that complexity within it. That's where this agent can rely on maybe, some sort of highly available key value store or highly available maybe some sort of locking system to ensure that you're not compromising on quorum. So let's go back to example here. So when agent decides that it is a time for that particular agent to upgrade the instance, so we have done something novel here, which is, if you are familiar with old live CD migration days, where you can boot into in-memory bootloader and flush the kernel with the new kernel and boot back onto the disk, with the new kernel. That's something similar we have done in our AWS ecosystem, which is agent decides that it has to support, it has to be on new instance, new AMI. So it downloads the AMI bits from S3 and put it in memory. And with the S3 bootloader, you boot back into the in-memory state, and you flush the disk with the new AMI contents, and then you again reboot into the new AMI, and all of a sudden, your instance is altogether on a new AMI, which is basically an immutable infrastructure. All of your systems within this AMI are well-tested with your build pipeline that I talked about. But the key thing here is we are not touching the Cassandra data at all. Like, Cassandra data is on the ephemeral disk as is, while rest of the tools and software is being upgraded to the new and latest versions. This makes easy for us to migrate our entire fleet with a click of button. But let's take the problem of a similar problem and try to apply to hardware. How do we migrate hardware? Again, it's the same intent-based solution. You have agents running on your machine. In our case, let's say the source is on I2XL, and intent store is trying to tell you that you should be on I2XL. Again, this agent has logic built in to ensure that you're not compromising on quorum, you're not compromising on any SLOs that you promised to your customer. And as one of the imperative solutions that we talked about is backups, so where your data is backed up to S3 all the time, incrementals and snapshot. So agent figures out if the data is there in S3 or not. When it decides, when it finds out that all of its data is in S3, it informs AWS control plane, launches a new instance. When the new instance comes up, the agent in the new instance finds out its peer that it is supposed to download the data from S3. It downloads all the data from S3. And whatever is the differential between its peer, a source instance, it tries to copy the data from source. And the agent on the old instance, when it is a time, it decides to kill itself. When the old instance gets out of your ASG, new instance comes into being. And this doesn't simply happen on single instance. This happens parallelly on several instances at the same time. Just to give you a screenshot, this is a 288 node Cassandra cluster in our environment, trying to update entire 32 instances zone at the same time. As you can see, 32 instances are healthy, and other 32 instances are trying to download the data and sync all the differential data from its source machines. Just to put it to numbers, imagine a scenario where each node is holding 500 gigabytes per node. With a Cassandra native replacement solution, it takes 200 megabits per second. So we are talking about roughly 6 hours per node. So to migrate a 288 node Cassandra cluster, it takes 2.3 months, which is impossible to operate at a scale that we are at. So then with the intent-based solution that we talked about, before doing all the fancy stuff of doing it in parallel, even if you were to do it in serial, it takes about, with the 200 megabits per second, it takes about 0.6 hours, which technically on a 288 node, with 0.6 hours to download the data from S3 and 10 minutes to fix up the data between the source and destination. So we're talking about roughly 2 days to migrate 288 node cluster with terabytes of data. But if your agent has complexity built in to ensure the quorum is not lost, but still you can do the parallel zone operations across your global cluster, you can bring it down to roughly 2 hours, because 0.6 hours, all instances in a zone can do it in parallel, and 20 minutes per zone to do the fix-up, and you can do 3 zones, and you can bring it down to less than a couple of hours. So with this kind of tooling, you can easily operate at tens of thousands of instances without too much of manual intervention. And this is all happening by simply putting one command in your desired store that I want this cluster to move from I2XL to I2XL. And the second part of it, so once we figured out, so the first problem we talked about is mutable interaction. And the second one is when customer decides to move on from one Cassandra to a different Cassandra cluster, we have built tooling similar to with the same idea of intent-based solutions, where you have tools in a Cassandra Java driver to do the dual writes to all your old and new Cassandra cluster. And your intent is to ensure that these old and new Cassandra cluster are consistent. So there's a forklifter and there's a consistency checker, which always work according to the intent of ensuring the data is consistent. And we rely on Cassandra's last writer wins concept and forklift the data from old Cassandra cluster to new Cassandra cluster to ensure that data is migrated to the new system. With that, I'll hand it over to Joey.
All right, so I hope that by now you guys see a lot of concrete, easy to kind of grasp examples of how you can take something that works on a couple nodes and then scale it to working on 10,000 nodes. But when you do that, you're still going to end up with some failures. Like Murphy's Law strikes everybody, it strikes Netflix. We have a whole talk on Thursday morning. I'm giving a whole talk on how Cassandra, when it breaks, how we fix it, how we debug it. In the interest of time, we're going to touch on just kind of one key takeaway that I think is relevant to the control plane discussion, which is this cautionary tale. So at Netflix, when you have, let's say, hundreds of automation jobs that are running all the time, it's tempting to say, well, we should only make this auto remediation run when I need to. So for example, in this case, you'll say, oh, well, we're running out of disk. Maybe we can clean up some stale backups and repair snapshots. And so you design your automation to trigger only when you're above the fatal disk threshold. But the problem is that the person who's implementing this infrastructure might not fully understand the guarantees that backups, that snapshots give in Cassandra. So in particular, the snapshot operation is just a hard link, which means that the modify time of the file is actually old. And this led to a pretty serious bug for us, which was that the automation, which only ran extremely rarely, when it ran in concurrency with a backup run, the auto remediation infrastructure would actually delete files that the backup was trying to put in S3, which led to a pretty big problem because we were violating our SLO that we promised our users that we'd give them fully consistent snapshots. Instead, we were giving them like partially consistent snapshots. So this is no good. And we can learn a lesson from this, which is that as you build these self-driving systems, make sure that you're exercising your rare automation all the time. This is very consistent with Netflix's like chaos philosophy, right? We don't just wait until an instance dies to say, can I recover from an instance failure? You kill instances. We don't say, hey, I'm going to wait until my disk fills up. You just run this automation all the time. We would have found the bug much faster. It took us a year and a half to find this bug because we didn't run the automation all the time. And I think a very easy to grasp example of this is this question. How many people in the room take backups of your databases? A lot. How many of you restore them? Okay, this is a lot better than when I asked the question a couple years ago. Good job, industry. How many of us restore them every day? Almost nobody in the room. One person. That's the next step. If you exercise your backup, backup and restore functionality constantly, that's how you know it works. For example, you saw that when we do state migration, we use the backups. We exercise the backups constantly so that we can trust them. When the rare occurrence strikes and we need to use them, we can trust them to work. All right, so we'd like to end this talk with this takeaway, which is that if you invest in that kind of infrastructure of sharing and tooling, context sharing, education, and you build your control plane so that they're declarative and run by themselves without your infrastructure, you too can run petabyte scale data stores. But realistically, not everyone wants to build all these, which is why we really encourage you to contribute to the Apache Cassandra Sidecar project, which we've recently kicked off in partnership with a number of other users, where we're trying to open source a lot of these control planes into one place so that you as users don't have to write them every single time. With that, thank you very much. If you guys have any questions, we'd be happy to take them. Do we have time for questions? Or? Okay. Any questions? No questions. People want to get to lunch. Yeah. Yeah. So the question was, when we're doing this hardware migration, how do we ensure that the differential is entirely copied? Can I take this? So it's kind of a two-step algorithm. So actually, a three-step algorithm. So the first case is we can download all the data from S3 as of the moment that we say we need a new data. But then there might be new data that's coming in. That's a good point. And that's where the differential comes in. So we actually take down the Cassandra nodes in a zone. So we take down the whole zone. At that point, obviously, mutations stop to those nodes, and we're relying on our other two zones to maintain quorum at that point. So we have the whole zone down. At that point, we do the kind of like a fix-up phase, where the agents cooperate and say, okay, well, what have I missed? And the hope is that at this point, we've missed a very small amount, and most of it is already backed up. Most of it's already backed up to S3. Like our backup system is constantly, the moment that an SS table hits disk, it's throwing it up in S3. So as a result, the agents can then do that fix-up, and then the only thing they have to do is do a digest. So we do a massive parallel XX hash. So XX hash is a wonderful hash function which can hash at your full disk rate. Like MD5 is 10 times slower. Don't use MD5. And the reason why we need a really fast hash function is because we need to be able to digest the data on both nodes in as little time as possible, because this is kind of like the critical period. That's where that 20 minutes came from. So it takes us about 2 to 3 minutes to digest 500 gigs with XX hash, and then it takes another like 2 or 3 for like Cassandra to start. So the final stage is kind of like a delta sync between the agents plus a full verification of the data using XX hash.
And the key here is immutable SS tables. Being the new SS tables are only going to be Cassandra is not going to change existing SS tables. The new SS tables are the only difference that are being transferred to the new node.
Yeah. Yes, we use both.
Both.
Yeah.
So you were mentioning about the when you were replacing the bootloader, changing the underlying software, and that's affecting the firmware volume.
Yes.
How would you say that? Because you need to shut down the Cassandra services, and once you shut down the Cassandra services, you use the data, and you might have to rebuild.
Yeah, so the question is, how does this not affect the Cassandra data? Like when we're shutting, if we shut down the instance, Amazon will get rid of the data. Is that, yeah. So we don't shut down the instance. We reboot it. We reboot it into a in-memory bootloader, so as far as Amazon's concerned, we just rebooted. So they don't actually assign us to a new machine. It's exactly equivalent to like if you run reboot. Yeah, so you reboot in place into an in-memory operating system, which then in turn is essentially an imager. So it works very similarly to how live CDs work. So like when you boot into a live CD, that's really the key insight is that we don't have to lose the data to do a software migration. We can just reboot into the new software through two reboots. This takes about like 6 minutes, maybe 7 minutes. The longest part is that our EBS root volumes are like 10 gigs and they're kind of slow, so it takes a while for us to write into them. But does that answer your question? Or okay, if you have more questions, I'm happy to go into more details, technical details, if you want. Any other questions?
Going once?
So the question was, what happens if the agent dies? Yeah.
So these agents are on a systemd controlled, so they always, when they die, systemd tries to restart them and keep it running all the time.
So if systemd dies, then the machine died. So the question is, how does the declarative system deal with the system dying, essentially, like a single node dying? Is that the question? Yeah. With no agent. Oh, okay. Yeah. So how does it deal with the agent dying and then a node dies and the new node starts up and I'm guessing is not running an agent? Is that the question? Okay. I guess to try to answer this question, the assumption is that instances are going to die everywhere. Like, so the control planes are built for this node might have died, and you can actually ask like another control plane. You can ask Amazon, like, is this node alive? And then Amazon will tell you, I believe this node is alive, or I believe this node is not alive. And that's actually one thing that we kind of try to reduce everything down to is, so all of our orchestration reduces down to the agent's running, and then the agent reduces down to systemd is running, and then the systemd is running, goes down to the instance is running, and then that is the source of truth of like Amazon's control plane or the cloud control plane. So we kind of have a chain of guarantees that we can use. Does that answer your question? Okay. Any other questions?
Yeah.
Do you want to repeat it?
So I think so. The declarative model, when you're running tens of thousands of instances, your application can also test your application of how your application behaves when these hundreds of instances going out, how they load balancer and how is it handling the failure scenarios. Yes.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that declarative control planes are a general concept. I don't think it's necessarily special to use them for stateful services, but we thought that it was we could demonstrate how you can use that tool to make operating large-scale data stores easier. But yeah, it's definitely a general tool. If you think about it, that's what like Kubernetes is. Like when you write into Kubernetes, I'd like three containers, and Kubernetes is like, cool, I made three containers for you. It's the same idea. All right, any other questions or?
Uh, So the question is, does Apache Cassandra Sidecar has a data migration feature? Not as of today, but that's where we would like to contribute majority of these tools into Apache Cassandra Sidecar project so that community can get benefited and we also get benefited.
Yeah, we've been working with the community for the past year to try to build consensus around we should have a sidecar. The sidecar should do these types of control planes. It actually took us a while. There's a decent argument to be made that says most people don't need declarative control planes. Most people just need something that can run SSH in a for loop for four nodes. So are we over-engineering? And I think we finally managed to convince the community that we've already built it. Like, we just need a place to run it. So someone's already done the hard work of building the complexity. It's kind of like the kernel, right? Like, no one wants to write a kernel, but you'll use a kernel that somebody else has built. Any other questions? So the question was earlier we were mentioning an agent. Is that something that we built? Yes. So and it's not one agent. So we actually build agents that handle different automation tasks. And so, for example, in this case, like Priam is our sidecar that handles most automation tasks. It's the agent that handles most things. But there's also like maintenance agents that handle things like
replacement,
data migration. That's a different agent. The failure detector agents, that's separate. So they're kind of like it's just you're still writing code. It's just you're modeling it in a different way. They're modeling the problem differently.
And agent doesn't need to be a separate process all the time. For example, the JVM quake is an agent as part of JVM itself. So sometimes it's a separate process, sometimes it's part of the process.
Yeah, sometimes it's just a background thread. Okay,
cool.
Thank you.